Well, thanks for coming again. I thought about what I talked about last week, and I thought I would spend probably the first 10 minutes or so recapping some of what I said, because it's a deep subject and there are many things, there are points that I sort of glossed over and didn't really fully cover, I felt, so I'm just going to go through them again. But one of the points I wanted to make when I looked at this map is that one of the things that I recalled is that we're all fairly clear about the sort of geographical division between the Theravada, which are based on the Pali Buddhist scriptures, which are the southern countries in the brown, and the Mahayana, which is mostly China, Tibet, Japan, Korea, Northern Asia. But one of the reasons I put that map up again is because the reason this happened is almost like an accident of history, because it was when the Chinese missionaries came to India to find the teachings, which actually was one of the subjects of that delightful series from the 1970s called Monk, when they went to find the scriptures, the holy scriptures, and bring them back to China. That's when they encountered the traditional teachings, which I suppose you would call the teachings of the Shravakas or the hearers from the viewpoint of the Mahayana, and the Sanskrit teachings, which became the basis of the Mahayana traditions in those countries. And so that was a period of time like probably, I was reading today that the earliest occurrence of the word Mahayana inscribed on an actual rock, so it's an archaeological relic, is about 100 years before the Common Era, BCE they call it, which is still pretty ancient. So the Mahayana is usually understood as having been like a later development, but really some of the indications of it goes really back a long way. In fact, some of the very ancient birch bark manuscripts written in Gandhari and Kharosthi script, which they unearthed in what is now Afghanistan, there are sort of Mahayana-related ideas in those very ancient texts. So this idea that the Theravada sort of hold the lineage that goes right back to the original word of the Buddha, and the Mahayana developed later, still open to interpretation, may not actually be true. Well, it may not be a black and white case. The Mahayana also have these ancient sort of origins. But the reason I put this map up again is because to recall that when the Chinese came and got these sacred writings, this was at the height of the Buddhist influence in India, because as we all probably know, by about the 8th or the 9th centuries, Buddhism had died out in India pretty well altogether for a lot of reasons, which is out of scope for my talk. So what the Chinese took back to China and then got translated to Korea and Japan were some of the were the Mahayana scriptures. And that's one of the reasons it took root in those cultures and began to thrive. Now, last week I showed this slide, but I wanted to read a bit more about this movement called the Great Assembly. The Mahasamgika. Hmm?
So what were the Chinese studying before?
Before what?
These.
I imagine they had the Taoist tradition that existed in China from time immemorial.
There were Buddhist monks in China.
Oh no, this is like when Buddhism got established.
Oh, right.
Like this is the very establishment of Buddhism in China, like the very first ones. There's a famous one called Fa Xian, who I think was around 350-400 Common Era. So that's pretty ancient. And I don't think there was a lot of Buddhism in China before that time. Before these monks went and got these scriptures and brought them back, and there were some famous names on both sides, Indians who went to China and Chinese who learnt Sanskrit, who did these amazing works of translations. One's called Kumarajiva. I mean, when you think about... Actually, one of the things that occurred to me when I studied this was this Tales of Going to India to Get the Scriptures is a very well-known historical book. It was written 400, AD, and it's been translated into English since about the 18th or 19th century, and it's got these fabulous tales of miracles and events and everything. But these monks travelled from China to India with donkeys across the edge of the Taklaman Desert in the very high country behind the Himalayas. And what they had to go through to actually go to India and get those scriptures, when they set off, it wasn't like there was no modern transport or communications or anything. It was really incredibly hazardous. And they had to go through the most extraordinary hardships to get just the scriptures and then bring them back and actually translate them. And nowadays we sort of tend to take it for granted because we have all of this knowledge at our fingertips. Like I can find a dozen different translations of some of these sutras. I can have them all open on tabs in my browser. And in some ways it devalues it, I think. Because you realise what they had to go through to just go and get those scriptures and just to be able to translate them and read them and just to contemplate the ideas in them was itself an entire life's work. And I think that is that's a reminder for the kind of ideas that we are dealing with here. Because, anyway, I won't get ahead of myself. I just wanted to say something about the Mahasamgika, which is the Great Assembly. Now, I read today again that this Great Assembly movement is associated with a second council, which I think is dated to about 325 BCE, so what we call BC, before the Common Era. And it was at this stage that this split began to emerge between what was called the Great Assembly, the Mahasamgika, and the Theravada didn't exist in those days, but it was more like the traditional schools. There were already a number of schools, the names of which I showed last week, but they were very hard to remember. But the Mahasamgika, they held the teachings of the Buddha were to be understood as having two levels of truth. This is one of the really interesting things about them. The relative truth, which is Samvritti in Sanskrit, and the absolute or ultimate truth, Paramartha. For the Mahasamgika branch of Buddhism, the final and ultimate meaning of the Buddha's teachings was always beyond words, and words were merely the conventional exposition of the Dharma. They also, so that is one of the doctrines that you associate with the Mahayana, especially the early Mahayana, the idea of there being two truths. The two truths doctrine was actually sort of spelled out by Nagarjuna, who I'll get up to a little later. But that concept is that the entire realm of science, convention, you know, law, politics, civic society, everything that we understand and know is all in the domain of what we call the realm of conventional truth. And that there is also the realm of discourse, which is spoken by the Buddha, refers to ultimate or transcendental truths, which are only visible to the enlightened eye of the Buddha, the Buddha's vision. Although one of the interesting and paradoxical things about Buddhism is that ultimately there are two truths. From the viewpoint of the conventional, there is the ultimate. From the viewpoint of the ultimate, there is only the ultimate. And that's one of the kinds of shifts in perspective that you constantly encounter when you're dealing with the Mahayana, especially. But the Mahasamgika was this school that had some of these key doctrines that then became later associated with the emerging Mahayana. So apart from this idea of there being the two domains of truth, the two levels of truth, they also believed that the Buddha, they made the Buddha, or they thought of the Buddha as being a supernatural, well, this supernatural is a boo word in our culture. Nobody likes to use it, but the word in Sanskrit is Lokvittara. And loku means word, tara means above or beyond the world. So it does, supernatural, another word for it is actually, supernatural is the Latin and metaphysical is Greek. They both actually have the same meaning. So it's something which is beyond the physical, whatever that might be. So the Buddha was characterised by his supernatural or Lokitara, world transcending nature, lack of defilements. All of his utterances expounded all the teachings in a single utterance. All of his sayings were true. His physical body was limitless. His power was limitless. The length of his life was limitless. And he never tired of enlightening sentient beings and awakening pure faith in them, having no sleep or dreams or no pause in answering a question. So this is a completely different vision of the nature of the Buddha from the traditional Buddhist understanding, where the Buddha was, in a sense, as I think I said last week, I think it's not correct to say the Buddha was merely or only human, because an awakened human is of a completely different type to the ordinary, or even to extraordinary people. So the Buddha is not simply a human being, but he certainly wasn't depicted in the sense of almost being like a deity that it came to be depicted in these early Mahayana sort of schools. So this actually gave rise to a kind of understanding which you found in not only in Buddhism but in various other traditional cultures, that the Buddha's worldly appearance or his physical body was really just an illusion, and that his real nature is something totally beyond the physical. And so that's actually called docetism, because it's in Christianity it's a heresy. They said the same thing about Jesus. Jesus you know, death on the cross was really just an illusory death, and he didn't really die, that his real nature was always alive. So these ideas circulated in the ancient cultures. But that's one of the teachings that's associated with this early Mahasamgika group. The power of the Tathagatas is unlimited, and the life of the Buddhas is unlimited. According to Guangxing, who was one of the Chinese who came over to get the scriptures, two main aspects of the Buddha can be seen in the Mahasamgika teachings. The true Buddha, who is omniscient and omnipotent, and the manifested forms through which he liberates sentient beings through his skillful means. For the Mahasamgikas, the historical Gautama Buddha was merely one of the transformation bodies, while the essential real Buddha was equated with the Dharmakaya. Now, it's interesting, this week there was a discussion on the... I'm on one of the online forums called Dharma World, which is quite an interesting place. And the owner of Dharma World had written an article on the original Buddhism. Like, he'd written for one of the... There's an online, like, Dharma wiki. And so he'd written this article and asked the members of Dharma World to critique it. And I was amazed by the fact that the number of people who said that... I do know that it is often said nowadays the original teaching of the Buddha is no longer accessible to us because it took such a long time for the teachings to be recorded in writing. The very first editions of the texts date from several hundred years after his parinirvana. So the oldest editions of the Pali scriptures that we know about are dated around 300 or 400 AD, which is basically 800 or 900 years after the Buddha is thought to have lived. So there's a lot of unclarity about whether what is in the Pali Nikayas, for example, was the exact word of the Buddha, so to speak. Nevertheless, I've always felt as though there was such a high degree of consistency with those teachings, and they just made so much sense as a coherent whole that I always felt as though that must be close to the original Buddhism. But I was amazed at the number of people who said, well, no, that's not the original Buddhism, because Gautama, Sakyamuni, the Buddha that we know and honour, is one of a whole series of Buddhas that have existed from time immemorial and may exist in other domains and realms. So it doesn't really originate with that particular instance of the Buddha, which I felt didn't like that really. So I expressed that view and then we all moved on. In fact, I think there was some debate as to whether the Four Noble Truths were really the original Buddhism. And there were a certain group on this forum who said, well, they're not really, they're like a diagnostic type of technique. They're just an example of the teaching, they're not the real original thing. Now, I just found that a really interesting discussion and just one of those things to sort of contemplate. But for myself, my attitude was that I think it certainly is said in the very early texts that the Buddha recognised himself as being the rediscoverer of an ancient path. He actually says that in the Pali Nikayas, that the way that he's found is something that has been known by previous Buddhas. So I think that's quite, how shall we say, orthodox. But the idea, therefore, that what the Buddha that we know, Gautama, spoke was not original to him, I didn't agree with that idea. I felt as though, because of the fact that his teaching has such clarity and coherence, and because it is so distinctive from all of the other world spiritual traditions, I still feel as though it has that real authenticity and originality to it. So that's just a little debate that came up. So, anyway, this goes back to the origin of the Mahayana. The Mahasamgikas, in the view of the Mahasamgika, the advanced bodhisattvas have, and this is one of their... This is one of the ways the Mahayana really defined itself separately to the older school. The advanced bodhisattvas have severed the bonds of karma and are born out of their own free will into the world and other realms in order to liberate other sentient beings. So that was a radical idea in early Buddhism, because according to what everybody felt the Buddha was teaching, once the arahat had realised freedom from the round of samsara, then he or she was liberated forevermore and no longer part of the entire cycle. Whereas this teaching was that the bodhisattva might choose not to sort of exit stage right, but might actually choose to continue being reborn for the sake of leading beings to enlightenment. And in fact, you do encounter that understanding certainly in Tibetan Buddhism, where there are these recognised lineages of incarnated figures. So they'll say such and such a Rinpoche is the X number incarnation of this great master from the past. So that's where this idea started to formulate. That originally the original teaching was that the Arahat, if you like, reached the very end of the whole cycle of existence and then went beyond altogether, which they classified as extinction in the sense of extinction of individual existence, whereas the Bodhisattva is able to voluntarily be reborn. Now, one of the interesting implications of that, in my mind, is that I think you can actually, if you understand and practice the Mahayana, you can actually adopt the view that you've volunteered to be born. And it puts a really different... It casts your life in a different light, because a lot of people say, in this day and age, people have this feeling that they've just kind of... that existence is a certain sort of a fluke. Actually, I was reading Bhikkhu Bolo's commentary on some of the early suttas, and he said, it's the commonly accepted view nowadays that life arises by chance, and that we're simply here because of some random shuffling of the death, some biochemical accident, which happened to give rise to a process, which happened to give rise to living beings, which we happen to be. And I always find that an unsatisfactory attitude, because I'd rather be part of a plan than part of an accident, is one way I put it. But I feel as though by having this attitude that we can be born voluntarily, it actually allows you to take ownership of your experience in a different sort of way. So instead of feeling I'm here because of my lousy karma, I'm here because I'm able to serve. So even in a practical, it may not even be true, but it's a really good attitude to take, pragmatically speaking, because it changes the whole dynamic of feeling as though you've been fated into something. So it's not as if you're not here by chance, you're not just here because of your karma, but you're here because of your desire to serve. So I think that's a way of enacting that philosophy on a day-to-day or in a pragmatic sort of a way. Don't you think? Yeah? Makes sense. So this is some of the slides I put up last week. I just said I was going to put them up again, partly because I lost all the fonts last week and they looked really lame. And I like this font, so I just want to put them up so they look nice. So, and we'll be talking a little more about this Prajnaparamita very shortly. As I pointed out, the Mahayana Sutras were these Sanskrit texts we'll be delving into in a little while. The Mahayana outlook had this view. Where they got this idea, I don't know, but the universe is infinitely vast in space and time. If you look up Indian Vedic cosmology, the Hindu sages had this idea that the universe occupied these enormous cycles, which they would describe in terms of the days and nights of Brahman. And those, when you actually do the sums, and Indian mathematicians were very advanced from very ancient times, when you do the sums, and I'm certainly no expert in the subject, either in modern astronomy and cosmology or ancient, but I do understand that the Indian astronomers and cosmologists, even though they believe, for example, that the Earth might have rested on a giant turtle, and so they had sort of mythological elements certainly embedded in their beliefs, they had quite realistic understanding of the vastness of the universe and how ancient it was, which is a source of some bafflement to modern scholars. They found that ancient Vedic records would talk about the universe being billions and billions and billions of years old, which of course the Europeans had absolutely zero conception of up until about the 20th century. And so how the Indians came to this understanding, we really don't know. I don't even want to hazard a guess. I do know that Carl Sagan, who was a very interesting sort of popular scientist who made a number of tele-series during the 70s and 80s, did a couple of his television shows on this fascinating fact that Indian and Vedic cosmology seemed to have anticipated ideas like the Big Bang and the idea that the universe expands and contracts through endless cycles that occupy billions of years. So again, how they came by this, Carl Sagan says it must have been inspired guesswork. Perhaps it was, we don't know. Perhaps they got visited by some of von Daniken's people. But that gave this sort of setting of the idea as I said last week, in some of the early Mahayana scriptures, there's these sort of references to the idea, to the fact that there might be Buddhas on other life-bearing orbs elsewhere in the universe. So it's, then I put up this slide, which is the, so by this, by the time Mahayana develops, the whole doctrine of the Buddha, or the teaching of the Buddha's essential nature is completely changed from being, I suppose in traditional terms he is referred to as the conqueror, someone who had overcome all of the defilements and hindrances, someone who is forever liberated from birth and death. But in the Mahayana, the Buddha came to represent a principle which was synonymous with the ultimate supreme reality. So that is connected to the idea of the Dharmakaya, which I talked about last week. The Dharmakaya is the ultimate reality underlying the universe, and what the enlightened ones alone can perceive, because they're not no longer caught in the illusion of separateness and otherness, which is the normal human state. There's the enjoyment body, which is the way reality appears to the bodhisattva, and then the actual physical realm. Now, look, believe me, these doctrines are really hard things to study and fathom. They're very deep. I don't certainly claim to have any kind of deep knowledge of them. One of the observations I will make, however, is that this idea of there being a trinity or three, a form of three, is another one of those ideas that recurs in many of the ancient wisdom traditions. So in Buddhism, we have the three bodies of the Buddha. Obviously, in the Christian faith, they have the Holy Trinity of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Now, I'm not saying these are equivalent or the same or anything like that, but it's just this idea of the threefold nature of reality is something that appears in various traditional spiritualities. And then in the Hindu faith, you have the threefold Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva as being the creator, the sustainer, and the destroyer. So one of the things I studied at university was comparative religion and comparative mythology, and it allows you to understand how some of these ideas have been represented in different cultures at different times, and you see these themes that emerge from these great traditions. So that's just something interesting to meditate on. Now, this is something I mentioned last week, and I didn't put up a slide, but I wanted to do so because I couldn't remember all the terminology. Mm-hmm. But right from the beginning of the Buddha's teaching, there was an understanding, as the Buddha was teaching liberation from the cycle of birth and death. Where are we in this cycle? Where's the you are here map? You know, like. So most of us are the uninstructed worldly, puttajana, which is the person that they're called the uneducated or the uninformed worldly. And quite often in the early Buddhist texts, you'll see these conversations between one of the monks or a questioner. They will ask the Buddha a question, and the Buddha will say, well, of course, the uninstructed worldling will do such and such or think such and such because they have no training, they've got no education, and so he uses them to illustrate the adverse consequences of following of your desires and passions and instincts, acting without awareness, not having any insight into your motivation. Most of us. That's the normal human condition. So that's, I suppose, like your baseline in a way. And then for those who are fortunate enough to have encountered the teaching, and to have come along and started to get training and started to understand the nature of mind and understand the nature of the hindrances, they pass through these stages. So a sotapanna, stream winner, I suppose that is like a convert in a way, like somebody who's heard the word, now I understand the word, I start to understand. So somebody who's, now that word conversion is actually interesting because I used to feel as though conversion was something like changing, adopting a point of view, or like joining a party or joining a political party. But in some ways, when you're dealing with spiritual matters as well, conversion is also, your thinking actually gets rearranged on a deep level. So when you understand identity view, what that's reference to is that most people have this innate sense of a very strong, I suppose the word is ego really. This is what I am, and it's something which is like never changes. And so identity view is having that strong sense of one's own identity and then clinging to that, then of course finding that as one goes through life, that is a source of constant disappointment because like everything else, it is always changing. So you're always trying to hang on to something which is always changing. So overcoming identity view is being able to release that obstinate sense of being stuck in the one sense of who you are. Attachment to rites and rituals, which is one of the things I noticed when I did my rite at the Nuntian temple, and they had the what that they stress, you know, don't be overly attached to rites and rituals in Buddhism. And overcoming doubt. So that's the characteristics of the stream winner. Then the once returner, who's going to have one more life. So I think the stream winner, they don't really specify how many more lifetimes they will go through. Anybody know better than that?
Seven,
that's right, seven. Once returner is free from central desire and ill will. The anagami, non-returner. And then the arahat, as we know, these are the four stages. Now the reason I put that up is because the bodhisattva takes a similar idea, but because of the emphasis on universal enlightenment and no longer just concerned with their own enlightenment, it actually means that there is a whole world of stages to go through yet, which I'll let you read these. They've got lovely names. These are all the boomies of the bodhisattvas. So each of these stages occupies one or more existences, lifetimes, many lifetimes.
The difficult to master.
I imagine they're not kidding. Now this is from the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is one of those Sanskrit sutras which got taken back to China and became the basis of Hua Yin, which is one of the very influential schools of Chinese Buddhism. But I did notice today when I was studying for this presentation that Edward Conza, who's a great scholar of Prajna Bharati, says these lists appear in those early texts, but later on, they don't get much attention. Most of them really stick with the traditional designation, stream winner and so forth and so on. This is like an elaboration that they created, and it's certainly part of the tradition. But I just wanted to put it up because I think it gives you, again, this idea of the vastness of the Mahayana type of outlook on life. The idea that there are these stations of awareness, all of which have detailed descriptions, but I didn't want to put it up because it's too much information. I mean, if you try and, you could do a whole course, you could spend so much, you know, delving into all these details. So I just love to put the names up as to what the characteristics are, so that every time, it's like you reach a certain stage and then it's characterised by you attain certain understandings, you develop certain attributes, you have certain abilities, and that occupies who knows how long. I don't know.
Are these different stages, or are they like a do they run in parallel to the four stages that were originally?
Well, I think, as we said, because the bodhisattva is no longer bound to be born,
so it's a different...
It's a different sort of dynamic, really.
Yeah, right. So it's kind of like... Would you say they're higher stages? Or
I think the Mahayana would say that.
Yeah, right.
You know, they sort of... Well, they did, especially at the beginning, as I mentioned last week, in the ancient world of ancient India, there was constant competition between different schools and sects, and so the Mahayana would, like, there was a lot of sectarian division, you know, our school is greatest because of such and such a reason, and so they would say these represent much more exalted states than the old wisdom school were capable of reaching, but for each individual to judge. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's a magnificent vista. Now these are some of the great Sanskrit sutras that became the basis of the Mahayana, and when I say the Chinese monks came and brought them back to China, these are some of the ones they got. So I'll say a little about them, and I'll even do some reading from some of them, if we would like that. Yes, so the Prajnaparamita sutras, there's a whole family of them, and they vary in length from, some of them are, I think, 108,000 lines. And I've always loved this sketch. They go through this, I'll build up to it. Because as Edward Conza, he's this writer, and I recommend Conza, I'm going to actually come up with some book recommendations, and he's certainly on it. He was someone who spent his whole career studying these scriptures. They became very elaborated over the course of centuries, and so succession of generations of monks that add more material to them, and they'd include all of the Abhidharma lists and a lot of repetition. So they became very voluminous, like some of them were sort of hundreds or thousands of pages long. They were meant to be recited. You said actually a lot of them have got absolutely brilliant ideas in them, but for that reason, a lot of them are also very repetitive as well, and they're rather hard to wade through. But the very shortest one is this one. That is the Prajnaparamita in one letter. So 108,000 lines and thousands of pages on the one hand, or there's a reason behind that, which I'll get to. It's not, it's the negative particle in Sanskrit. So it negates, it's like if you, it's like the known is one thing, the unknown, so it's the negative particle. So what it says under this explanation, it says, not only in the volume of the sacred literature is Buddha, A is not only the first sound in the Indian alphabet, it's A, and in this respect, the beginning of all spoken and written knowledge. It is also the prefix by which all affirmative notions are negated. So it's the negative particle. By denying the essentiality of appearances, it becomes itself the essential symbol of the essential. Well, I mean, the way I relate to it is it's the not. And it's because whatever you think it is, it's not. And like you're always, your mind is always trying to grasp what things are. You know, is this, is that? It's not. And that becomes a very powerful meditation. That's really the gateless gate in one letter. Because you have to always remember you're not knowing. You're not knowing one. This is Zen teaching.
Does it have the Chinese translation?
Sanskrit. No, it's Chinese different though because it's not a phonetic alphabet. It's symbolic. So I don't think they've got a letter. That's literally the letter A.
Yeah.
It's the negation.
So the Chinese suttas, the equivalent to that.
I don't know. That's an interesting question. I suppose it would be like, perhaps it's that Zen symbol of the unfinished zero, you know, that very famous one.
Yeah.
Or Mu.
I was thinking that.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Like one of those kinds of koan type.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would probably be the nearest equivalent. Yeah, that's very much the... So there's the Prajnaparamita, which we might look at a bit of. Then there's the Diamond Sutra, we spoke about last week, and that's a very famous scripture. It's there's many editions in print, and also a very nice edition online. Now the Siddharma Pundarika, which is the Lotus Sutra. Is anybody here familiar with it? Anybody encountered the Lotus Sutra? Because again, it's just this, it's like about the size of the Bible. It's not that big, but it's an enormous book, and it's full of these amazing parables. It's got the parable of the burning house, which is the one where the wealthy father, his sons live in this mansion, and then fire breaks out, but they don't realise the house is on fire, so he has to entice them out with toys. There's all these, it's loaded with parables, all of which are parables, of course, for the Buddha trying to attract the attention of the foolish worldly people so that they understand the predicament they're in. But the Lotus Sutra in itself has become the basis for a large, you know, like Nichiren Buddhism and other schools of Buddhism in China and Japan. They're just based on the Lotus Sutra, just that one scripture. So one of the points I wanted to make about these, the Mahayana Sutras, is that whole schools are based on them, and you can spend really, they can become the basis of your meditation for your whole life. You sort of pick one and then you really, you learn it and it becomes part of your entire being. There's these ones which I won't try and pronounce because my Sanskrit is very poor, but the longer and shorter ones there are the basis of the Pure Land schools. Amitabha. Now, interesting thing I learned about Amitabha. That word mit is measure, meter. It's the same root. And ami is not measured. So boundless, immeasurable Buddha. That's where the word comes from. I'd love to learn that because there's that sense of boundlessness, but it's actually in a word which has transcended all of the different languages and cultures. Now, the point about the Pure Land schools in Chinese and Asian Buddhism generally is they're devotional schools rather than being philosophical or yogic, that sort of thing. They're based on developing faith in the Amitabha and the recitation. People often say, well, isn't that just like Christianity? But no, it's not, because the content of their teaching is is very different. The attitude is the same, in some, or the attitude is similar in some respects. But I've encountered, I've only just started to delve into, I mean, again, I keep reminding myself how much information there is in all of these teachings. But when I started to read articles and read about it, I haven't gone to any of the actual schools yet. They have their own, each of those schools has their own approach, their own liturgy, their own scripture, their own meditation. And they've all got, they're all, I suppose, one of what they call 84,000 Dharma doors. There are so many ways to approach the teaching. And they're yet another one. And I mean, I think there's a Shin Buddhist Association up my way in the northern part of Sydney, which I'm determined to go and visit sometime this year, because I'd like to learn more about them. So that's the longer and shorter Sukhavati Guha Sutra. Vatamsaka Sutra. Now, this is a massive book. When I did Buddhist studies at the University of Sydney, the lecturer there, Ed Krangle, said, oh, you should get the Vatamsaka. Just read through it slowly. I've got it. And it's so daunting. it's just got so much in it. So I've read little bits of it, but it's like one of those things you'd have to go and spend time with to really absorb yourself in. It's a massive book, huge. Then Lankavatara Sutra, which is these last two are very important for Zen and also very important for what's called mind-only Buddhists. I won't try and explain their contents. I just wanted to give you some of these names. This became, and there's more, I mean, if you delve into the scholarship, there's a great list of these, but these are some of the famous ones. They become the basis of Buddhist culture all throughout East Asia and also in Tibet, although you'll find that some of them, for various historical reasons, are more favoured in East Asia, some more in Tibet.
Tibetan have even more scriptures?
They have... even more, I think they have the same basic corpus that they translated from Sanskrit, but then of course they also have the tantras and their commentaries, and so they have a lot of material. There's a fair amount of commonality between the Chinese, I think, and the Tibet. I don't think the Tibetans have all of what the Chinese are garments, though. I think they have the complete set translated from the Pali, because the Chinese took them so early. So they have overlap, but they're not all identical. And again, the amount of information involved in learning what's in all of their... So I'll go back to the previous one. So the early, as we've already established, the Prajnaparamita was like the very first development of the Mahayana schools. And I'm putting up this slide here because in the ancient world, this beautiful goddess was wisdom. Prajnaparamita was actually always depicted as... not always, but quite often depicted as a female or a feminine spirit. And that is a beautiful sculpture. I've seen that in... it's not a particularly good reproduction in that photo, but it's Javanese, I think. And it's made out of sandstone. And I think it's from about the 6th or 7th century, which is interesting because Indonesia was Mahayana up until... what is now Indonesia, up until, I think, about the 12th or 13th century. But... Prajnaparamita is known as the mother of the Tathagatas, the mother of the Buddhas. So wisdom, it's like the idea of wisdom being the mother which gives rise to the Buddhas. So Konza, who I mentioned before, he says that such figures, that again, in the ancient world, this is one of those comparative ideas, that at the same time we have this beautiful figure of Prajnaparamita in the Buddhist world, in the West we have the figure of Sophia.
Yeah.
And there's that beautiful Hagia Sophia, which is a beautiful church or mosque or both in Constantinople. Mm-hmm. And Sophia is also depicted as being a beautiful version. Actually, I think one of the key messages is that wisdom is something that you have to, how shall I say, know how to approach. Otherwise, you know, you can't bully it, or you have to seduce it. Perhaps it's one of the reasons. The underlying sort of psychological, psychodynamic. So this is another figure from one of the very early illustrated Prajnaparamita scriptures, where again we have that same figure. And this one as well, which this is a superb artwork. That's from the Ajanta Caves, which were, I would really like to see one day, although I don't know if I will. Anybody been to the Ajanta Caves? they're in southern India, the most magnificent sandstone caves with these huge deep caverns and passages in them, and a lot of beautiful artwork. So, what is this Prajnaparamita? Prajnaparamita. That's the key teaching of the Mahayana still. Even though it's associated with the earliest part of the teaching, it's still central to it, even in this day and age, right up till now. So the Prajnaparamita, the word itself means Prajna is wisdom, and Paramita is wisdom which has gone beyond. So the object of the transcendental wisdom is beyond ordinary vision, beyond mundane intelligence. That's a quote from the Prajnaparamita Sutra. No wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection. We said this last week. No bodhisattva, no thought of enlightenment. When told of this, if not bewildered and in no way anxious, a bodhisattva courses in the well-gones of wisdom. So that's a fairly paradoxical statement. It's telling you to seek something that there is that you can't. No wisdom can we get hold of. What do we make of this? What's our reaction to that? I mean, you know, because it's paradoxical. It doesn't make sense. It's telling you there is this great wisdom, but then it's telling you there's no wisdom. So what's it telling us? I'm not claiming to know that. I mean, my interpretation is that the way I've come to understand it is that, again, it's because we want to see something, right? Hold on to something. We want to feel as though we know what it is that we're dealing with. And we want to have a sense of getting somewhere and having something to attain. And you see that the Prajnaparamita is always undercutting that, because the whole idea of me attaining something, then again, it's all about my attainment and all of the great spiritual merit and qualities that I'm going to have as this tribute bodhisattva person. So it's always undermining that sense of you being able to do any of this sort of thing, because you have to actually surrender and give up the idea that you can get this. I read one great aphorism which goes like this: the unattainable is attained by non-attainment. And it's the very opposite of, even though they talk in terms of these levels of attainment, the whole way they're attained is by always giving up trying to grasp things. That's the paradoxical nature of the Prajnaparamita. And it's very, it is very daunting in a way, but I suppose to bring it down to a very simple level, the book which actually got me to this room at this very moment, which is the one I read in 1973, was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Suzuki Roshi, who's the founding teacher of the San Francisco Zen Center. And his instruction all throughout that book is, firstly, you have to sit, you always sit, every day sit, and do all of the other parts, aspects of the Zen, Soto Zen, you know, discipline, which is like live your ordinary life and do your work, and all the things you have to do, but you sit without any idea of gaining something. And this was his, always this very firm sort of, if you feel as though you're going to have some special experience or gain something through this practice, then you're setting off in the wrong direction. And that's what makes it such a hard discipline, because you've got to do it, and it's not a real fun type pastime, you know. Like, you've just got to commit yourself to this path without feeling as though you're going to get some great reward from it. You have to go beyond that searching for reward or fulfillment. And then you start to understand, the way I understand it myself is that you start to understand what you already have, which is one of the greatest things you can understand. That's just my personal interpretation of all of this material. So does that resonate? Or, So the themes of the Prajnaparamita, the idea that it's most associated with, in, if you ask anybody who studied Buddhism as a subject, it's about the teaching of shunyata, which is a deep and profound idea associated with this famous Buddhist sage by the name of Nagarjuna, who is also known in many of the East Asian traditions as the second Buddha. So what is this emptiness? Now, I think, like, when you discuss emptiness on the Buddhist forums, people have these enormous flame wars about whether they understand it or not. And it causes considerable, like, you know, angst. But I think there's all different levels of understanding it. And it's not really so scary. If you think, one way I think about it is the emptiness of possessions, attainments, and status. All the things that people invest importance in. Like they navigate their life with respect to who they are, what they've got, what they've achieved, those sorts of things. So there's actually a biblical teaching, all is vanity. It's a little like that. It's reminding you that all of the things which you hold precious and think are so important are transient and they will end. Everything is impermanent. It's like sunyata is very related to impermanence. Now I did find, just got to gather my thoughts here, because there was one particular scripture which I wanted to read, and it's, I think it helps to understand emptiness in a very straightforward way. So just bear with me a sec while I find it. Access to insight. So yeah, emptiness, shunyata, certainly means that one way I interpret it, and I wouldn't say it's an authoritative interpretation, is, as I say, that it undermines your tendency to attribute importance and significance to your possessions, your status, and those things. So it certainly undercuts that, because we must remember that the Buddhist teaching is essentially a renunciate philosophy. So it has to do with learning to understand the impermanence of your possessions and your identity. That's part of it. Let me just read this. Yananda Sutta. It's a very simple sutta. Simple but deep. The wanderer Vajragupta. Now he's a character that appears in the early Buddhist texts. And Vajragupta is always asking philosophical questions. He's the one who says, ask questions about whether the Buddha continues to exist after his parinibbana. Does the world have a beginning? Those sorts of questions. So his character represents this one who's always looking for, like, deep metaphysical explanations. So Vajragupta went to the Blessed One, and on arrival exchanged courteous greetings with him. After an exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he asked the Blessed One, "Now then, Venerable Gautama, is there a self?" When this was said, the Blessed One was silent. "Then is there no self?" Second time, the Blessed One was silent. Then Vajragupta the wanderer got up from his seat and left. So that is the origin of the middle way philosophy. And then why is it? It's because Ananda then says, "What gives?" Ananda says, said to the Blessed One, "Why, Lord, did the Blessed One not answer when asked a question by Vajragupta the wanderer?" And this is the real crux of the whole thing. Ananda, if being asked by Vajragupta the wanderer if there is a self, were I to answer that there is a self, that would be conforming with those Brahmins and contemplatives that are exponents of eternalism. We'll have to unpack that a bit. But then, if I was asked by Vajragupta if there is no self, were I to answer there is no self, that would be conforming to those Brahmins and contemplatives who are exponents of annihilationism. So these are the two. So does the self exist? No answer. Does it not exist? Still no answer. Neither yes nor no. So this is the beginning of the middle path, because the eternalist view, and this is in the context of the Buddhist culture of his day, there were Brahmins and ascetics who believed that through the right spiritual practice they could be reborn in propitious circumstances forever and ever. That there was this eternal soul that is unchanging from life to life. So that's not the Buddhist teaching. It doesn't teach that. But he also doesn't teach that at the end of life there is nothing, annihilation. So it's neither eternal nor is it annihilated. Everything arises by way of dependent origination. And understanding the nature of dependent origination is the Buddhist path. Understanding how everything arises through causes and conditions. So I think the message to Vajragada is you have to go away and think more. You have to understand who is asking this question and what is putting up this question and what, you know, all of the things, all of this churning of the mind trying to come to these answers. This is what you actually have to penetrate. Mind you, I don't want to put words in the Buddha's mouth. I'm saying that. He didn't say that. His answer was silence. So I know that's a difficult point, but it's a very important point because that silence, that non-answering, is like an instruction in a way. It's like we have to observe that. I suppose that's what meditation is. It's going into silence. And it's also resisting the conclusion to jump, resisting the urge to jump to the conclusion is or is not. So this became a shorthand for all different kinds of what's called wrong views, most of which fall into either the trap of being eternalist, there's something that lasts forever, or into the opposite extreme of being nihilist, that nothing has any real being. And you see, these things actually do play themselves out. I think many people in modern culture are quite nihilistic. It relates to this idea that we hear by chance, nothing has any reason to it. It's a nihilistic view. So these things do operate in the back of our minds all the time. So I just wanted to make that point because I feel as though that's a way into this teaching of Shunyata. But if you feel as though the teaching of Shunyata is baffling, it certainly is. There's no question about that. Like realising the nature of emptiness is like a life's work. You meditate on it and it gradually starts to, its meaning starts to percolate through. One thing Thich Nhat Hanh says, which I think explains it really beautifully, is that because due to emptiness, everything exists independent on everything else. So he calls that inter-being. We all think of ourselves as like a separate island, a separate centre, which is itself and then other selves out there. But in actual fact, everything that exists exists in relation with everything else. So he says, we, this is pretty awkward English, but it conveys the meaning, we inter-are. That's the way Thich Nhat Hanh puts it. Yeah.
He also says that we are entirely made up of non-self elements.
Yeah, that's right.
And that really helps me.
Yeah, beautiful. Because, you know, like there is no permanent thing.
Yeah.
And it's a completely dynamic, always dynamic and flowing reality. And that's you know, this is perfectly true. Very well said. So realizing emptiness is both the means and also the end. That's really what you're working with all the time in the Buddhist path. And that's the major theme of the Prajnaparamita sutras. Pardon me. All beings possess the capacity for enlightenment, even the lowest creatures. I read an anecdote today where two of the great Tibetans were having a formal debate and then one of them picked an insect or something. And then the other one reprimanded him for, you know, not having respect for life. And it defeated him in the debate. I read that 7 Years in Tibet, which is a well-known book, because the young Dalai Lama was very interested in modern technology in the West and so forth, so he wanted a movie theatre built, but it got held up for months because they had to evacuate the earthworms. You know, that sort of thing. So all beings should be treated with compassion. That's part of the implication of that. And this is the Bodhisattva Dharma. They repeat this in many monasteries. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. Delusions are endless. I vow to cut them off. The teachings are infinite. I vow to learn them all. The Buddha way is inconceivable. I vow to attain it. It's called the Bodhisattva vow. They repeat that in Soto Zen monasteries every day. So, now I think my feeling is that's probably enough information, isn't it, at the moment, I think? Yes? No? I just don't want to flood you all with too much.
We're good.
We're good? Still good? When I think about it, I always feel as though I talk too much. Ah, yes, now I've got a special treat here. Ah, this is really good. I'm really glad I came up with this one. You're just going to give me a moment to get my stage, my props together. I found a good way of doing this. I found this really beautiful site called Bodhisvata, which has got these absolutely superb Sanskrit recitations on it. It's very beautiful. Well, I have to line it up here. I have to just connect my little speaker. So what we're going to look at now is the way of the Bodhisattva, Bodhicaryabhatara, which is a very, it's probably one of the most influential scriptures in all of Mahayana Buddhism. It's like taught through all of the Tibetan schools, and I think most of the Chinese ones as well. It's by a monk called Shantideva, who's a very, when you read about his character and attributes, he was a delightful individual, not the least of which is because he was not at all pretentious or precocious. He's a very humble working monk, and you'll notice that from, let me just connect my, little speaker here, so I'm just trying to think it'll work. Yes, so I've got this beautiful recitation from just the first six verses of the Bodhicaryabhatara. It's okay. What's the technology gadget, man? Give me a sec. Coming.
Atha buddhicitta nusansa nama prathamah paricchedah. Om namo buddhaya. Sugatān sasutān sadharmakāyān pranipatyā daratokhilām savandyān sugatātmajasam varāvatāram kathayisyāmi yathāgamam samāsā. Nahi kinchida purvamatra vachyam nacha sangranthana kaushalam mamasti ataeva name pararartha chinta swamano vasaitum kritam maedam mamata vadanena yati vriddhim kushalam bhavaitum prasada vegah athamat samadhatureva pasyet aparupyena matopi sarthakoyam Chana sampadiyam sudurlabha pratilabdha purushartha sadhani yadinatra vichintyate hitam punarapyesa samagama kutaha Rātrau yathā megha ghanandhakāre vidyut kshanam darśayati prakāsam buddhānubhāvena tathā kadācil lokasya puṇyesu matihi kshanam sya Tasmāt suvam durvalameva nityam balam tu papasya mahat sughoram tajjiyate nena shubhena kena sambodhi cittam yadina manasya.
Thank you. the beginning. It's quite long. But I'm going to study this one because it's just actually hearing the Sanskrit. I studied Sanskrit. I'm not very good at languages, but it's a beautiful sounding language. And I just feel as though that really, this speaks to me, this verse. So that's the way of the Bodhisattva. And one of the sayings I remember from it later is that all misery in the world arises from seeking one's own pleasure. All joy in the world arises from seeking the happiness of others. There are many gems in this text. It's a very, very beautiful text. So, books. This is when we put it on the site, you can download it. But these are all things that I've been studying for years and really particularly recommend. I mean, there's thousands of Buddhist books now, I know. But Khonsa is really good on the Prajnaparamita and early Mahayana. He's well known for that. And he has a very, very acerbic kind of, very witty kind of take on all of it. This is a really good one for understanding the Prajnaparamita from Thich Nhat Hanh. Because the Heart Sutra, some of these sutras, they seem so, when you read them, they're so counterintuitive and so puzzling. But when he explains them, suddenly it all just starts to click. This one was a really, really helped me in my university studies. And this one I mentioned last week, David Brazier, his current author, and I really like his work. He was a psychotherapist as well as Dharma teacher, and I really like his attitude. I mean, he's much more, I think he has a better kind of spiritual understanding than many of the contemporary teachers. I think he's a good counterweight to Stephen Batchelor.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting title, Buddhism is a Religion.
Yeah, I found the book through the article in Tricycle magazine. And it was a protest against this secular Buddhist movement, which is good as far as it goes. Secular Buddhism is very helpful and very good in its place, but it's becoming a little militant.
Well, Winston Higgins is coming next week to talk about secular Buddhism, bring your questions, guys.
Well, I don't want to diss it, I don't want to put it down. It's just, I think it has got a spiritual, and Buddhism is a transcendental, philosophy, faith, religion, it is. And like you can experience and learn a lot from the engaging with it on the secular level, but where it becomes problematic in my view is when that becomes like a positive program of saying redefining Buddhism in secular terms, if you like. But that's another night. So that is all the material I have. I just wanted to have some discussion now. And is that all right?
Yeah. Thank you, John.
You're talking about ultimate reality in terms of the supernatural.
Well, yeah, the boo word I used, yeah.
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 Yeah. You really mean that, Troy?
Well, I said the other alternative supernatural is metaphysical. I learned the other day they both are the same word. One's Greek and one's Latin. And I think our culture has got... I think modern culture is about the supernatural like Victorians were about sex. It's like, it doesn't dare mention it. It's kind of like this boundary. You don't dare that you admit there could be such a thing. I mean, I think I've come to the view that I think there's certainly... I acknowledge there are realities which are not known to either the ordinary human mind or to scientific analysis. So I guess that must be supernatural. As I said, the Buddhist word is Lokottara, which is... beyond this world. So, what does that mean? I mean, sometimes I feel as though one of the images I have is that anybody who is engaged in a spiritual practice, there are moments, I suppose you say they're epiphanies, where you suddenly have that glimpse when everything seems so clear. Quite often they're very, they occur very quickly. Every time in my life, it's always been a sudden moment of absolutely profound understanding. And then, the part of it is, I've always realised that, but then I never knew that I knew it. That's an aspect of it. But the feeling I get, then of course it dissipates, for me anyway, then it's just, you know, you've got to get up, go to work, do all the other stuff that you have to do, and it's gone again. You can never capture it, that's one of the beautiful things about it. But the feeling I get is that we get these glimpses of the totality, and most of the time, and I suppose there's another biblical saying there, we see like through a glass darkly, we don't see the whole. And I think those moments of visionary experience, and certainly what the sages and mystics realise, they have this vision of the whole, and they see a much, how shall we say, larger and less fragmentary. So I suppose you could almost look at that naturalistically in a way. If you believe, one of the things I noticed in my little reading there from The Way of the Bodhisattva is how can we fulfil our human potential? Now that's something you'll find in a Buddhist text, which I don't think you'll find in a lot of Western, that idea, the human has a potential to realise a higher state. So those higher states are from the viewpoint of us puttajana, something beyond our worldly comprehension. So in that sense, I suppose supernatural. But then, for those who live in those states, it's natural to them. Like an Augustine quote is, miracles are not against nature, they're against what we know about nature. And our knowledge is so, it's fragmentary. And one of the key, how should we say, attributes of the Mahayana is the Buddha is all-knowing. Now, I don't know what all-knowing means. I mean, omniscience, I've tried to read up on it, and it's a daunting subject to understand. How could somebody, any kind of being, be all-knowing? I don't know. I give up, don't know. But I think there's a reason that's said. I don't think it's vain. I don't think it's, I don't think it's a superstitious idea. I think there's something in it. So the Buddha understands and sees something which we don't see. And see, that grates with the modern sensibility. And I think partly it's because in the modern world, it's like one man, one vote. Everybody is said to be equal. Well, in a sense, we are equal. I think the law has to treat us as equal, and we should treat each other as equal, and we should value everybody equally. But at the same time, not everybody has equal knowledge, and not everybody has equal vision or wisdom or capacity. And certainly, you know, these teachers in these great traditions, they have an understanding which I know that I don't have, but then from learning from them, I can feel that I start to understand things that I previously didn't know. So, and that's along a kind of vertical axis. It's like not something which our secular culture likes to acknowledge, I think. And that's, it is, I don't think the word is politically incorrect, but it's, there's tension around it, because I think for most of us, we feel as though the question has been settled. You know, science has proven that the world operates according to clockwork and mechanical rules. We've put that in a box, put it over in the corner, and we don't open it again. And so, when it gets opened, it makes us uncomfortable because, by golly, there's a whole lot of stuff I thought I'd dealt with, and now I have to look at it again. And that's one of the reasons I've taken refuge, because I have confidence that the Buddha has all that stuff handled. I have confidence that, you know, like, if that's sort of looked after. I don't have to, I mean, it allows me to live in a world where there are other levels of being and other realms. There's probably ghost realms, higher realms, lower realms. It doesn't scare me anymore that it's like that. I had an insight at a Roman Catholic funeral I went to for an esteemed family friend about 7 years ago. And the liturgy was very beautiful. And through my studies of religion, I've started to understand the symbols of the liturgy in that Catholic church. And it was this sort of great relief that I could relate to the liturgy, and I could feel the sacred in it without feeling as though I either had to be converted to it or reject it. I could just be at peace with it, with the whole Catholic mind now. I don't feel as though it's something, and that's something I've sort of come to through studying the spiritual traditions. So yes, I do believe there are higher levels of reality. I certainly do believe that. When you look at those traditional Buddhist artworks of the wheel of birth and death, the six realms of existence, they denote profound realities. It's not simply like an old-fashioned idea or a tradition or something. They denote something real. I mean, I don't want to impose on anybody how they should interpret it, but I also, if they said, well, it's just folklore, I wouldn't agree with it. There's something, what they do denote a reality, and that reality is bigger than what's known to either the senses or to natural sciences. But as I say, that's one of the reasons I take refuge in a way, because it gives you it's refuge, because it does give you refuge. You know, there are forces and all kinds of unknowns out there, but you know, like if you take refuge, then you are protected.
Good, thank you.
Can I ask three questions?
Sure.
The first one is, if being as bodhisattva is so important, then why didn't the Buddha adhere to the idea to keep coming back to save more people? The second one is there any reason why the meaning of bodhisattva changed throughout the course of history in terms of the Theravada meaning of bodhisattva compared to the Mahayana meaning of bodhisattva? And the other question was, have you read any of Bhikkhu Anarayo's works on the birth of the bodhisattva ideal?
I touched on it. Yeah, I saw some of those online some time ago. Yeah. I haven't delved into them. But in answer to the first question, Bodhisattva in Pali was always part of the Buddhist tradition. And in fact, one of the sources are the Jataka tales, which are the stories of the Buddha's previous life. And I was reading a really interesting study the other day which said the origin of the paramitas, the six great virtues, was the Jataka tales. Because in the Jataka tales, the Buddha-to-be represents each one of those virtues. Great courage, vigor, energy, and all of those things. So the Bodhisattva, I personally, the reason the Bodhisattva orientation became so important is because I think Buddhism would have possibly died out without it, because it was a very elite, it was focused on these elite ascetics whose life was based on being supported by the laity and being removed from the world. And it didn't offer that idea of universal wisdom and salvation for all beings that was offered by the vision of the Bodhisattva and the Mahayana generally. So it really allowed Buddhism to become like a universalizing religion. Now, it's like there's a lot of speculation that part of this was a result of the contact between other civilizations and the influence of Greek and Christian ideas on Buddhists. And I mean, they all influenced each other. They used to travel on the Silk Road and debate all the time. I don't know whether that's true or not. But the Bodhisattva in Pali and the Bodhisattva idea, those ideas were in the Pali already, the idea of the Bodhisattva. And it is true, I think, from the viewpoint of the conservative tradition, that there are certainly a lot of doctrinal innovations in the Mahayana. So I wouldn't want to, I mean, somebody who, if that is your tradition, then I wouldn't want to try and dissuade you or convert you out of it. They are doctrinally innovative. They have these pretty wild ideas. That's one of the things I try to make the point. Mahayana ideas are just totally out there. So, you know, I'll let you make your own judgment as to whether that is a valid development of the original teaching. But they would say it is. They said that, first of all, there was the first turning of the wheel, which is the deer park at Benares, and the revelation of the Four Noble Truths. And then there was the second turning of the wheel, was the Prajnaparamita scriptures and the teaching of emptiness and the Bodhisattva idea, which is associated with the Vigarsana. And then they say the third turning of the wheel was the Yogacara and consciousness-only schools. But a Theravada would say, look, there was only one turning. And see, I don't want to adjudicate that myself. That's the way they see it. And I mean, you know, personally, I suppose because the first contact I had with the Buddhist tradition was through reading popular Zen books, Alan Watts and Suzuki and those people, and that's a Mahayana orientation. That's where I feel as though I have the most affinity with. But I also think that there is continuity between the earlier tradition and the later one. I can see the trajectory of thought, so sort of thing. But I don't know. It's up to you. Was that all three questions? I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, how come the Buddha? I think her first question was why the Buddha didn't remain in the world as a bodhisattva.
Why did he?
Which is quite a loaded question.
Why did he?
Why didn't he?
Is that, well,
yeah.
bear in mind that when he first became enlightened, he seriously considered not teaching at all. And then, according to the legend, as we know, Brahma Sambhapati came and spoke to him and said, "Look, the sacred those with little dust in their eyes, for the benefit of many, for the will of many." So he taught for 40 years. He didn't have to do that. He didn't do it for his benefit. You know, he did it for the benefit of everyone, benefit of the whole universe. And so, and the other thing is the Mahayana's, and in fact, as I said, I think in the early tradition as well, there is this recognition that there were previous Buddhas right from the start of the tradition. So, you know, it's not hard to imagine, once you allow the fact that there might have been previous Buddhas and there will be future Buddhas, that's very much in keeping with the Mahayana idea, and that's also there in the early school. So that's okay. Yeah.
Is it reasonable to think that he did continue in his disciples?
Well, in that sense as well, his word, he said, you know, he who sees the Dharma sees me. Like there's a sutta where this monk says, "Oh, I was ill, I wasn't able to come, and then it was the rains, I couldn't come, couldn't see you." And the Buddha says, "You don't have to see this body. He who sees the Dharma sees me." And that's the whole idea of the Dharmakaya, where the teaching itself, the principle, is then the Buddha. And that's what the Mahayana picked up on. Oh, not just his body anymore, but actually the body of the teaching. Where's that? It's everywhere. And it's like, one of the things about emptiness as well, one of the things that I'm grooving on, is it's also transparency. That everything, every apparently solid thing, is actually just see-through. And what is the reality behind that is something unthinkable, but it's constantly giving rise to all these countless forms. And, you know, like that is the nature of the deep nature of being itself. Yes.
Just trying to agree with the prevalence of Mahayana, especially in modern times, is the reason why Mahayana school is so dominant or prevalent is because it was preserved in China?
Oh, that'd be a large part of it, I think.
Yeah. But all the other schools definitely survived.
Well, actually, one thing I would say is Mahayana is not necessarily a school. It's like an entire kind of movement, of which has a number of schools as part of it, sort of thing. But as a movement, I think it survived, as you say, because, well, that was partly the reason I showed the map as well, because the Sanskrit text that formed the basis of it got migrated through China and translated, and then became hugely influential in China and Japan and Korea. So in that sense, became part of world culture.
Also because it became printed too.
And printed, actually correct. I mean, the earliest printed text was the woodblock Vajratetika, the Diamond Sutra, which was printed by the Chinese in 413, I think. Mm. Yeah. And the thing about Buddhists is also they're extremely good arguers, and they memorise their texts really well, and so they lent themselves to being able to convert people and get the word out. They travelled along the Silk Road, both west and east. There's actually fragmentary Buddhist legends in ancient Europe, like in the so-called Dark Ages, like in 400, 500, 600 AD. There's Balaam and Jehoshaphat, which is a part of the European folklore, and that's been identified as being a reference to the Buddha. So, and it was the Mahayana who travelled, mostly, who went along those trade routes and everything. Because you recall, one of the origins of the Mahayana was they insisted they'd be allowed to carry money, because they couldn't beg when they're out. When you're travelling in strange lands, you know, you can't be a begging mendicant in a place where they don't have begging mendicants. Otherwise, you'll starve. You know, so that became. So they had to adopt and sort of become more liberal. That was part of the rationale of Mahayana. But then there's been a real resurgence, and the forest tradition in Thailand and Burma has also had huge impact in the modern world because of those teachings, Mahasi Sayadaw, and you know, they've got a lot of, you know, because they democratised the whole meditation movement. So, you know, Buddha's one whole, not doing too bad in the modern world. Because it's so adaptable. And because it's brilliant.
Sutra and those kind of things. Do they have a parallel in Pali?
Not really. This is where the Theravada say they don't recognise the sutras at all. That is only recognised. And they recognise they might, contain, the right ideas and principles, but they don't recognise them as being the Buddha Sasana, the actual word of the Buddha. So, no, they don't have the parallel. And also the Heart Sutra actually has got an interesting story. The scholars nowadays think it actually originated in China and they've got translated back into Sanskrit. It was based on a gloss of the Prajnaparamita Sutras that went over to China and then became Chinese, then they composed all, and then went back and got translated into Sanskrit again. But no, they're definitely, they don't have a direct parallel. No. So you'll find the Mahayana schools generally have Abhidhamma, which is very similar to the Pali one. They have a lot of, and they all recognise the Pali Nikayas, the Nikayas or the Agama, as they call it in China. It's all common to all the schools. But then when you have the Sanskrit type of sutras, then they're not recognised by the Theravada. That's like the dividing line.
Final question? Great. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That was very useful.
Thank you. And I'll make a PDF of this so you can hang it on the
Thank
website.
Thank you. Most appreciate it. And any links that you wish to share,
oh, yes.
That'll be wonderful too.
Okay.
So thank you, Jonathan, again.